we're talking about big things, big ideas, I've found an illustration, the things that work well is to try not to talk about a big idea with a big idea. What you do is you find something small that serves as a metaphor for a bigger idea, and that it has a way of inviting people into it. They can discover the metaphor.
That was John Hendricks. He's a nationally known illustrator and a professor at Washington University. He was just talking about how illustration can be used in all walks of life. I'm Willis Reuter Arnold.
And I'm Nancy Fowler. And this is Cut and Paste. So the stories just tumble out when you get together three illustrators, two reporters, and a room full of about 100 people, which is exactly what we did recently in our very first live cut and paste called The Art of Illustration. We talked with John Hendricks as well as two former students, Fox Smith and Vidya Nagarajan.
To get things going, Nancy asked what some of their first professional assignments were like.
Yeah, it was a train wreck. I got my start, I did a few things right out of school, but basically when I came out of school, I was not prepared to be an illustrator. I got to New York in 2001 and went to graduate school with the purpose of trying to figure out who I was. Now, as an artist. And while that was happening, I was also trying to get work. Now, that's a combination that doesn't go well together if you're trying to satisfy a client. So my first job, I ever got a real call, like where a stranger called me up and said, hello, are you John? Are you sure you can handle an assignment? You look pretty new. Was from the Village Voice. This was right after 9/11. We saw 9/11 happen right out of our window. I was scared of New York City to begin with. That happened. I was really unprepared for this illustration assignment. That's what I'm saying. The art director, I sent him three sketches and he rejected all those. And I sent three more and he rejected those. And then he suggested two ideas. And then I drew those and he rejected those. And then he finally said, listen, I think you just gotta like draw a bunch of pirate businessmen with like dollar bills for sales on this boat. And I was like, okay, I can do that. At this point, this was, believe it or not, before I scanned my work and turned it in digitally. So I had to hand deliver this to the Village Voice. And so I'm an hour away from when I need to catch the subway and get this on time, otherwise I'm not gonna get it in. And that was when the plane crashed in Long Island. It was right after 9/11, I don't even remember it. But there was a scare that it was terrorism again, they shut down all the subways. And I was on my way to the subway and they said, nope, nobody in or out. So I thought, this is it, my career is over, my first deadline was blown. And I just remember walking back thinking, well, I tried. You know, I had a good career. I had one assignment. But I talked to Min Young, who's still a guy I keep in touch with. He's at the New York Times now. And he was very understanding, and it ran. It looked awful, but I somehow survived onto the next one.
So I like that you actually started with a good disaster story, but yeah. I'd like to hear what our other kind of panelists have to say. What was your first experience, Fox?
My first really, really professional one was probably with Hired Inc. It wasn't quite as disastrous, I don't think. But basically, it was a children's book that was... And these are books that go into clinics for... they're pretty topical. They're about teaching children how to deal with asthma and things like that. And so the first one was a really nice, easy topic, which was foster care. I say that sarcastically.
Nice, easy.
It was not nice and easy. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it in a way that would... be respectful and not really scary, but understanding of what was going on. And I didn't have to go on any subways. I was able to turn it in digitally.
Yeah. Much smarter tactic.
Vidya, what about you?
Yeah, so my first one was for Time Out Chicago, which isn't a print magazine anymore. It was really exciting for me when I got the email to do something because it was about 8 or 9 months after I graduated. And I hadn't gotten any work yet, and I was really just feeling like, oh, what did I just
do? It's over, yeah, right.
Why did I major in this? Mm-hmm. Am I going to be living in a box? I was just really scared for those 8 or 9 months. So when I got the first job, I was super excited, and it was this tiny spot illustration, like a fourth of a page in a magazine, and it was about how the White Sox were playing the Red Sox in Boston. And I sent in so many sketches because I was just so hyped up about this assignment. And now I usually only send two or three. And, you know, they picked one. And I spent like 48 hours on this thing, and it was such a small illustration. So it was a good experience, not quite as dramatic.
No, but I think all these, like, they share this weird thread of, if you're going to be a successful illustrator, almost everyone has this panic mechanism in them. And some of it is coming out of school, you are so geared up for this, and you're so, you know, the level of failure is so high that you overperform to the point of complete anxiety in a way. And part of it is just the weird thing in art school. Like, we all went to an art school that cost us basically $200,000. And we're not exactly coming out with a medical degree, you know? So there's this immediate sense of overwhelming dread that I have to get this to work. And I actually think that's kind of an asset to our field in a way. It's almost like an extreme sport early on, where you get the call and it's this mad, crazy rush. And I think if you love that, you love illustration.
I'm curious, how did each of you kind of get past some of those initial feelings of, like, what did I just do? Like, yeah. How did you motivate yourselves to keep going out there, submitting work, and keep drawing?
When I was just starting out, if there was, you know, I wasn't getting a lot of work, so I would make assignments for myself every week that I made myself do. And then I would send those things out to people to look at, whether it was through email or I would print out postcards and send it to them, just so that I knew that I had something to do every week, even though I wasn't getting paid for that thing. Mm-hmm. That was really just a good thing to keep my momentum going.
Because the freelance world as an illustrator is weird, because it's like being an actor, where instead of auditioning, we send these postcards. I mean, you know, even in the digital world, these postcards still work, and they go out, and people, art directors, pin them up, and you hope basically to get a call back.
And sometimes those postcards, I mean, I've gotten calls where I've sent out a postcard, and a year and a half later, the art director will contact me and say, oh, you know, I saw that postcard of the tiger that you sent me a year and a half ago. It's been sitting on my bulletin board, and I have a great assignment for you.
See, you can't delete a postcard. This is why it's better than email. Yeah.
Well,
they
people
stay
like
there.
Things, too.
Right.
I'm curious, John, you mentioned, like, the high rate of failure. So why does anyone go into this field, and what, I mean, knowing that, you must have, you know, something really compelling that makes you go into this field, and how do you have the confidence to think you'll be different?
Enjoying
anybody?
Punishment.
What?
Enjoying punishment.
There's a sense that you don't have any other options, in a way. Like, it's like, this is what I can draw. I better make this work. Some of it is the fun of the high wire act of being on stage, in a way, and making it happen. I think illustration, in many ways, is one of the more marketable and enjoyable arts that actually people interact with in a very regular, normal way.
Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, because I have my hands in many, many a pots. I do a lot of performance and different things like that. But I think the one string that ties all of them together is storytelling. And the thing that I really like about illustration is that you can tell a story and give people a visual. And even with a single image, you can do it in such a way that you instantaneously get an idea into someone's head. You know, the nice thing about editorial is you can put things together almost like a puzzle in such a way that they understand what you're saying, where you're coming from, where you're trying to go, just by looking at a single image.
Right.
And it's such a powerful thing. And to be able to be involved with that and to be able to affect other people with any messaging, I think, is addictive.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't diminish expression. It doesn't remove it. It's just a different quadrant of saying something.
So one of the things that you've kind of mentioned, a couple of you, is that, like, storytelling is really important. But the actual images that you're drawing aren't necessarily, like, linear. They're not necessarily a story with a narrative. How do you kind of, like, get a story across when it's just a static image?
I've definitely seen a lot of pieces that will be maybe accompanying a news story or something that has some sort of visual metaphor that is communicating the story in a new and different way. And I think that's really what's exciting about it, is being able to see a single image and being able to look at it and pick out, oh, I see this is happening here. Oh, this represents this. And being able to get all this information from such a singular piece of thing.
Well, and a buzzword that's happening right now in our world is narrative, the idea of what is narrative. Even brands talk about it. Like, you know, what's the narrative of the Nike brand? You know, I mean, in some ways it's like, it's a little bit of a stretch, but I bet if we had to sit down and you had to write a story about the main character, Nike, you could probably do it, right? You would just do it. You could come up with a narrative that was about Nike, right? So I think the same thing holds true with any sort of visual single image that we as human beings, when we're given imagery that we don't understand, we naturally order it into story. And so illustrators sort of use that to our advantage, and we can take disparate elements like a snail and a suit of armor, and suddenly you put those in the same image, and your brain is going to turn that into a story. You basically can't help it. So I think that's some of the fun, is pushing that to the very edge of what makes sense and then letting the viewer participate.
Tell us more about the brainstorming process that you go through when you have a project. Like, how do you get ideas? How do they come to you? How do each of the, you know, successive first drafts, I guess, mm-hmm. would be a way to put it. How do they come to you, and how do they progress?
Well, anybody? We don't make any mistakes. I mean, it's basically a one-shot deal.
Just start with the ink and then go from there.
I can't even remember doing a first draft that wasn't great.
So do you draw whatever comes in your mind? Do you think about it? Do you listen to music?
I would like to revert back to something I learned at WashU from someone at this table.
This is so great.
But something I remember learning was that starting off, because I think a lot of us went into it with the idea that, okay, we're going to do this piece, and then I'm going to go ahead and start drawing out the final lines, and that's going to be really good, you know, or maybe I'm just going to take a pen and start going from there or something. And the idea of going into it with really small thumbnails that don't even really look like anything, that just kind of basically get where the visual information is going to go, and then build off that, and starting small and then building from that, I think helps the piece to come together a lot easier, and it helps just in case you did put that tree in the wrong place. Suddenly it's not a crisis. It's much easier to work your composition.
Yeah, I think we're probably all of us on this table are practiced enough at this that we could do finished art without a sketch. But the whole cornerstone of the illustration discipline is iterative, is that as you make something, you reiterate it, you do it again in order to basically create enough data that you can find the best version of it.
Well, I think even when we do come out with basically the Mona Lisa of illustration, the first go, many times the clients may not really see the vision in the same way that we do, and so may be having to make some edits from that point anyway.
Right.
Yeah, I think just starting out with those thumbnails and just getting a gesture of what you want the piece to kind of look like is a really important step for me. I also, just coming up with things to look at as inspiration, like I have a folder on my desktop of reference images from everything, from like National Geographic to fashion magazines, and I try to take some of those things that I see and bring it into my work, because if you enjoy, you know, your reference material, or if you enjoy a certain thing, it's going to make that drawing process more, just way more enjoyable for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge of illustration is, let's say you're given a piece about pension fund managers fighting over the same clients, right? That's actually one I've illustrated a couple months ago, right? The literal content of that is a complete snooze, right? There's guys in pinstripes, there's briefcases, there's actually no there to draw. So if you try to be too good of an illustrator, you're going to be sucked into this content that you hate. So Vijay is exactly right. Having a well of content that you can go to that's yours and that is drawn from your set of inspirations. So instead of drawing guys in business suits, you draw, wolves eating guys in suits of armor, right? That's stuff that I want to draw. And can I turn what I want to draw into a metaphor that other people can understand? And that probably even those business people would rather look at.
I was going to ask specifically what it's like to work on assignment when you're doing freelance work and that sort of thing, and how you have to engage with the ideas you're presented. We just heard John's answer, but I'd love to hear from each of you as well.
Tears, crying, no. It really depends. I think it's much easier with the books that I do because I'm working very closely with the author throughout the process. So I think that makes... We're working on thumbnails together, so the outcome is not a complete and total surprise to everyone. But when I'm working on branding materials, and that's a little bit more into the design world, I try and bring someone along with me on the journey of creativity that I'm going on and be like, okay, here's some sketches, we're going this direction, okay, this is the next version, we're going along here. And you just try and involve someone in that sweet space between being too involved and being not seeing at all what's going on. But even then, you're still going to get to the point where you show somebody who has been there since the beginning a finished logo, and I quote, "It's just not moving me." So, you know, and then someone says to you, "Oh, well, it's just not moving me." And you think to yourself, "Well, I don't know what to tell you. Do you want me to push you down?" You know, what do you want? I think a lot of times it's difficult to deal with clients who aren't necessarily as visual as you are.
Sometimes I'll get clients who have a vision of exactly what they want. Like my first year, I was supposed to draw something about Lollapalooza, and they sent me a really crude sketch of exactly what they want. Okay, we want this like giant foot to come and like stomp on the festival. And you know, they had the whole thing drawn out for me. So when you work with clients like that, it's kind of a bummer because you don't really get to, you're just a renderer for them.
Right. So, and it's not uncommon to get people who didn't go to art school drawing pictures for you to copy, basically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you do your best to handle that as a professional. But the great art directors, you would want them to trust you and trust your vision for what the piece says to you. I think if you want to be really optimistic, every assignment is basically about learning in some way. Like, I'm going to get this piece and I'm going to learn about nuclear warheads. I don't know anything about that, but I'm going to have to draw one pretty soon. So you see it as an opportunity to explore ideas, I think. So even in a really bad assignment, I still can see it like, okay, I'm going to learn something at the end of this.
Well, and even in the idea of learning something, working on anything over a period of time, even you will learn more about how you're approaching the process, what your own visual language is going to look like.
Right.
You know, and working on the books that I have, I've taken a lot of, it's not necessarily the content I had always envisioned myself from a child creating, but it's interesting. And after that, I'm able to kind of refine my own work by having done other work.
Yeah, and I think all illustrators who do this for a long time learn that you've got to make yourself interested in every assignment, because you got to finish it. Like, you got to turn it in. Someone's going to pay you for this, so you better be pretty invested. So how do you trick yourself into being invested in something that maybe is not interesting to you?
John, you and I were talking earlier about how the world of illustration was, until recently, dominated by white males, and how that is changing. And I wondered, Fox and Vidya, if either of you have found barriers in your work in that way?
The main thing for me, like, Hired Inc. is a women-run company, so already I'm starting from a place where it's a little bit of a different dynamic. The main thing for me has been, where can I include diversity in the work that I'm creating? You know, and which of these characters can I make? Okay, this one can be, you know, ethnic in some way, and a lot of our books deal with, you know, we did one about disabilities where the main character is in a wheelchair, and I'm working on one for cleft palate right now. So kind of including a lot of different kinds of people and making sure a lot of different demographics are represented. So for me, it's not been as much being judged or held back by that, but seeing what can I do with what I'm doing to make sure everyone's included.
Yeah, it's also kind of hard to tell, for me at least, how I'm being judged, because I do work by myself. I'm not, you know, interacting with people on a day-to-day, and I'm not even really talking on the phone with these people. It's all by email, so it's kind of hard to tell what these people are thinking of me. Mm-hmm. But I totally agree with what Fox said about just trying to create diversity in your work. You know, how many ethnicities can I get in here? And like, does everybody have to be like the stick thin person? No. And a lot of the times our directors will tell me before I start sketching, like, oh, make sure that there's a range of people in this crowded scene. Mm-hmm. So we'd really like that.
Yeah.
So clients are asking for that diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the legacy of illustration was, it's easy to forget this, but in the turn of the century, in the 1900s, illustrators were the richest people in America, almost. I mean, they were like the Steven Spielbergs of America, because we didn't have movies, we didn't have television, we had illustrators who made these fanciful pictures, and they made, in today's market, bazillions of dollars. So there's this weird power structure that was built into the hierarchy of illustration that was about rich white dudes, and it's why, you know, they have a beautiful building in New York, the Society of Illustrators in the Upper East Side, that if illustrators today tried to buy a building in the Upper East Side, it would be a little closet. It would be the bathroom in a Starbucks.
Yeah, I think on that, I saw an article on Facebook about It was entitled, If I Don't Animate Black Characters, Who Will? And it was something along those lines. And kind of the idea being that if, as a person of half color, I'm not representing myself and others, other people might not just be thinking about it. You know, it's something that's very much on my mind, so I'm in a position where I can do that and make it more normal, especially marketing books at children, making a diverse atmosphere much more normal to children so that they get out in the world and they grow up and they are more accustomed to seeing a wide range of different people, all doing a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit like each of you feels a sort of sense of responsibility with the images and the work that you're doing. How do you try and translate that kind of into motivation for your work?
The cliche about illustrators is we're completely driven by the clients. We don't do anything until someone calls us, and then we just sit there inert waiting for someone to tell us to draw, you know, a popsicle with a snail on its head. Like, you know, we have no ideas outside of a client. But I think that has really changed ever since basically the death of the commercial illustrator in the late 60s. And young artists now today, I don't think really distinguish between their own work and client work. And I think most people bring stuff from their sketchbook, from their own interest, what they're reading at home, and hopefully are making their own projects. And then they're getting calls from editorial clients, advertising, and then they go back to their comics or their zines or their books that they're working on. So, and I think all that comes from your past, the things that you were interested in, where you grew up, all that stuff.
Well, for me too, like I'm very involved with other groups in St. Louis that are involved in activism and equality and things like that. So for me, it's kind of the natural way for it to progress. These are things I want to see change. These are things I want to see in the media that I look at. So I can at least include that in what I'm doing.
If you were asked to do a project that involved illustrating St. Louis as it is right now, what kind of elements might you include?
Ooh, man, oh man. Well, you know, Bob Stack, great illustrator, did a New Yorker cover right after the Ferguson events that had the arch that was halfway completed and two strands, one black, one white. I thought that was a really brilliant piece of visual communication. It's hard. I look at that and feel like, whoop, that's done. It's hard for me to think beyond that, but I think when you're talking about creating when we're talking about big things, big ideas, I've found in illustration the things that work well is to try not to talk about a big idea with a big idea. What you do is you find something small that serves as a metaphor for a bigger idea, and that it has a way of inviting people into it. They can discover the metaphor in it.
I think a lot depends, too, on who it is you're trying to communicate to. A lot of the things I've been involved with have really opened my eyes to the connectivity between a lot of the different arts communities in St. Louis. So for me, it would be something along the lines that shows how these different communities are all interconnected and how many people are, I don't want to say networking, but kind of making connections and working together and collaborating and showing kind of that side of it, which not everyone may see, but the people who are involved in that would instantaneously understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
If I were to do that, I think I would just think of my point of view. What are the things that I like to do in St. Louis? Where are the places that I go? Starting with ideas like that, just it should just be about what you love about St. Louis. It doesn't have to be this grand statement about the city.
So I'm really curious, you know, if you're kind of using this personal perspective, how do you think about audience? You know, we've talked a little bit about what it's like to draw for clients and things like that, but you're not just making something for your clients, you're making something that your clients will use for other people. So do you kind of, how do you do that? You know, just five words, I don't know.
You sort of have to trick the client into paying you to make an image that you would have made on your own anyway. And that takes a long time to figure out that dance. And usually it involves learning that you don't send the one. What you think is like, I'm going to send the two really good sketches, but they asked for three, so then I'll put like the bad one in there. But no one's going to pick that one because it's obviously so bad. And then they pick that one every single time. So then you learn, okay, don't send a bad idea. Why didn't I think of that to begin with? But it is kind of a game, and so, honestly, sometimes you don't win it. You make work that's not great. Hopefully, the client loves it. At the end of the day, maybe you don't put it in your website. You know,
And each of you does work that's not necessarily for a client. There are own projects. I know you've mentioned like working when you didn't have work. How do you kind of make sure that what you're doing continues to be something that would be applicable in this vein as well?
You know, I think Fox is actually really good at this. I feel like you're so good at like living a creative life around you. Like one of my first experiences outside of her as a student was we saw her in a play of The Lord of the Rings, and she had made it was The Hobbit. She had made the dragon Smaug, and it was the coolest looking dragon ever.
He was pretty cool.
And, I mean, I was truly amazed by it. It was like you were doing an art project. It was like an installation that just happened to be a play. And so I think you're good at this.
I think, John, you said something really poignant to this, that you are trying to sell to clients work that you enjoy doing. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, you're going to still be doing work that you love. Like, we do this because we love it. I'm assuming all of us.
Right.
It's not just that.
We don't get paid enough.
Right. We're not just pulling in huge bags of cash or anything like that. And so that being the case, we're wanting to work on it even when there aren't other things going on. And so for me, you know, there's another side project I'm working on that is my own kind of thing with the interest that I have for another book series, just of my own, which... it's just what I'm interested in, so it's easy for me to work on that.
Yeah.
And then that also feeds into what I'm getting paid for, because they're the same thing.
You know, you become interested in the work that you're doing by doing other things, like observing other art, going to movies, reading books, going to the
museum. You can write off anything.
Yeah, it's tax deductible. But doing all of those things really just filters down into making art also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're like, you're building a visual morgue in your library, and you're pulling stuff out of that every now and then when you make imagery. Hopefully someone buys it, but you know, we all have projects, whether they're in our sketchbook or stuff we do for fun. You know, maybe it's doing a t-shirt for your friend's band. I mean, sometimes stuff like that is incredibly fun because it's just an outlet. It's just, there's no pressure to it.
Well, I think a good thing too about getting a lot of inspiration and seeking different experiences, it can change the way that you think about things. When you see a film that was really mind-shattering and it was, you know, and it cause you to start to perceive things in a different way, you can always take that back into your own work and be like, oh, I have all these new ideas now because, you know, oh, I saw these two visual things come together that I never would have thought of before. And looking at other artists' work and kind of staying up on what people are doing, listening to different kinds of music, like everything that you do can inform the way that you're creating and the way that the creative process is going on.
Well, and as an illustrator, you have this strange visual lens where you're always looking at everything. Like on Twitter the other day, there's a huge illustration community on Twitter. It's very fun. But future Hall of Fame illustrator, Sam Weber, tweeted at me that he was watching The Bachelor and noticed the light striking one of the contestants' hair and diffusing in a certain way. And he said the next day in the studio, he emulated that in his painting. So he is now, the reality television is now a part of his inspiration cycle. And I just love that about illustrators. They're just always like seeing how things look. That's what drawing really is. Drawing is learning. You end up learning a lot about the world.
So one of the things then that I'm curious about is if you're talking about passion and kind of this dedication, what's one of your favorite assignments or projects that you've worked on recently, and how did that come to be?
Actually, I've done a few pieces for NPR.
Synergy.
But no, they're really great. I do them for the shot NPR Shots, the health blog on npr.org. And one of the recent ones was, it hasn't been published yet, but it was about dentists and how they're painting fluoride on adult teeth now instead of just children to prevent cavities.
Oh.
And the art director that I work with, Meredith, is so great. She just kind of lets me do whatever I want. She unleashes me. So I drew these two dentists who happen to be my dentist and my friend who is a dentist, and they're like defending
free cleanings for life.
Right, they're defending this tooth against evil cavity arrows. So I mean, it's really fun. They just let me do whatever I want, so I like them.
I have a bunch that I really like, but I always think back on a couple. There's one piece that I particularly love because of the experience surrounding this piece. Story time. I illustrated I guess one might call it a fan piece. But if anybody's familiar with the show Firefly, I did a version of this as if in old traditional Japanese style, and I put it on Twitter, and then Nathan Fillion, who is the former star of that, actually retweeted it. And then later on that year, I actually was able to meet him and give him a print of this, and it was a very exciting thing for me.
That's great. Illustration has a way of doing that sometimes. I mean, I've written and illustrated my own books that have, those have been very fulfilling and like truly like a life goal experience. But I got asked last summer, I did this drawing that, this is related to fandom. I did a drawing about Star Wars where I drew everything from the trilogies I could from my memory without looking at reference. And it became, I've never really had a viral hit of anything, but this is the closest it came. It was kind of everywhere over the internet for a couple weeks. And anyway, the actual Star Wars people saw it and hired me to come out to their D23 con in August where they were launching the toys from the movie for Target. And so they hired me to draw Star Wars while like R2-D2 was driving around next to me. I mean, it was one of those surreal moments. Like if the 10-year-old version of myself could see me, it'd be like, you have done it. Like you have arrived. There is no more that needs to be accomplished.
And at the very end, one of the people in the audience raised their hand and they asked, are all illustrators this much fun? And so we figured, okay, well, this must have been, really satisfying for the audience. I know it was for us.
Yeah, we had a really great time, and we look forward to doing this type of event again in the future. This has been Cut and Paste, a production of St. Louis Public Radio.
Produced by Willis Ryder Arnold.
And Nancy Fowler. The music you've heard throughout has been made by local musician Eric Hall.
You can find Cut and Paste at stlpublicradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts.